Chapter 17. On one of those days during the holidays, when they were completely bored, Webb came up with a plan. The five of them sat by the river, at the very spot where Webb dreamed of building a house. "We build a tunnel," Webb said. "It runs from my house to Tate and Nani's, and then we take a detour, and it goes from their house underneath the driveway and into the clearing."
"Purpose?"
Jude asked, practicing his overarm with rocks against the tree.
"To get around after hours. It'll be tops."
"Tops, will it be?"
"The Great Escape! They build a tunnel," Fitz said, enthused.
"They needed two morons. It was a matter of life and death,"
Jude said dryly.
"We're bored to death, Jude, so isn't that a matter of life and death?"
Tate asked. Webb was grinning. Tate too. They always grinned in unison. Like they were thinking with the same mind, sharing the same heart. Ever since any of them could remember, Webb and Tate had been like that. Jude knew it was why he was drawn to them. They were like beacons for Nani, who couldn't seem to operate without them, and Fitz and Jude loved the three, unashamedly.
"They think I saved them, but they saved me,"
Fitz once told him.
"I didn't exist before I belonged to the fucked up four."
"Five,"
Jude had corrected. He could hear Webb, Tate and Fitz discussing the tunnel as if it already existed.
"Nani, explain to the delusional trio why the POWs needed that tunnel more than we do,"
he said. "Nazis," she muttered, sitting against the tree. "Bad day for Nani."
"Weren't your grandparents Nazis?"
Fitz asked, lining up at least five imaginary enemies and with his finger and popping sounds, eliminating them one by one.
"They were Germans," Nani said. "Big difference."
"Although Omar Rose was a Nazi when it came to eating the sauerkraut,"
Webb said in a bad German accent, and for the first time in a long time, Nani laughed.
"I'm all for the tunnel. It could save our life one day,"
Tate said.
"We could be chased by evil and have to hide down there."
"Evil? Out in Jellicoe, I wish,"
Fitz said.
"Think of how tunnels save people from Hitler,"
Tate said.
"Yeah, but last I heard Hitler was dead. The bunker? A gun? Eva? Ring a bell?"
Jude said.
"Cyanide,"
Nani corrected.
"We'll pretend we're the East Germans trying to escape to West Germany. No Nazis."
"Just communists."
"All we need is to be able to get from one house to the other, and then from that house to the clearing,"
Webb said, slightly frustrated by the fact that nobody but Tate was taking him seriously. Jude looked from Tate to Webb, shaking his head.
"You know what?"
Webb asked.
"I'm getting another fantastic idea."
The 7 p.m. call bell rang in the distance, but Webb was in another world.
"Skirmish," he said, impressed with himself. "Let's have a war."
There was a new plan every day, bigger and better than the day before. Every afternoon at 4 o'clock they would meet to discuss it. On Jude's last day, they met at midnight and camped under the oak by the river. Fitz handed them a bottle, and Webb took a swig, spitting it out instantly.
"What the hell was that, Fitz?"
he asked, trying to regain his breath.
"Grappa. Got it from the Italians next door. Burns your insides out."
"And the enjoyment is?"
Jude said, taking a swig, his eyes instantly tearing up and his breath coming in gasps.
"I reckon if I put a match right here, you'd see fireworks,"
Fitz continued, taking out his matches and breathing heavily into the air. Still trying to recover, Jude stared at him.
"Why would you want to do that, dickhead?" Live on the edge, G.I. Jude. That's my motto.
Fitz took out a cigarette and Jude grabbed it out of his mouth.
You gonna set us all on fire, you homicidal feral fruitcake?
Hand it over,
Tate said, taking a few deep breaths before swigging from the bottle. She stared at Nani in shock and started coughing out of control. Nani fanned her down, patting her on the back until the coughing subsided.
Can we stay focused?
Webb asked, taking out a purple leather book.
Mate, no one is going to take you seriously with a book that looks like that,
Jude said.
Yeah, Chairman Mao and his little purple book,
Fitz said, laughing at his own joke.
It's Chairman Meow to you, and I've got a system set up that's going to blow your mind.
I wouldn't mind other parts of me
Fitz! Tate said, grossed out. Major Lee.
Is anyone listening to me? Webb asked, annoyed. Is that too much to ask?
I am,
Nani replied. Webb leaned over and grabbed her face.
Then I can die happy.
Nani patted the space next to her, and Fitz sat down obediently.
Okay, we play skirmish, Webb said. Cadets, townies, us. We split this area up into territories, and anyone who tries to invade loses ground. We have rules of engagement, diplomatic immunity, and one or two fisticuffs.
What part of this are we going to enjoy?
Tate asked, pointing to Nani and herself.
The part where we take you hostage and ravage you,
Fitz said.
You're an animal.
Fitz did gorilla impersonations, and Nani shushed him gently.
Fitz, you head the townies, Jude heads the cadets, and I'll get the houses together back here. We need to get the six houses working, so we need rules.
No fraternizing with leaders of other houses, Tate said. Rule number one.
Webb looked taken aback.
What happens if you do?
He asked, jumping on top of her and trapping her with his arms and legs.
The two leaders get placed in exile, together, for the rest of their lives.
Okay,
he said with enthusiasm, jumping off her. I'm writing that rule in. No relationship between leaders of opposite houses.
I've got one for the territory wars,
Fitz said, his eyes bloodshot from the spirit.
If trespassing occurs, there's payback.
He jabbed at thin air.
One to the jaw, two to the gut.
So what does the winner get in the end?
Tate asked.
They get to sit around with the losers and say, I am King Xavier of the world. Repeat after me.
And me?
Tate asked.
You get to be my queen.
Tate looked pleased with the idea.
How come you're the leader of the community?
Nani asked, almost smiling.
Why can't Tate be?
Webb looked at his sister, grinning.
Why can't you, Nani?
Fitz leaned his head on Nani's shoulder.
And I'll be your queen.
You can be the eunuch,
Jude said, shoving him out of the way.
And I'll be her prince.
He bowed and took Nani's hand, kissing it, and their eyes met. It was awkward for a moment, until Nani looked away.
So how long will it take to get your troops in gear?
Webb asked him.
We're serious here, you know.
Mate, we've been ready for years.
By the time you come back next year, we'll be ready, tunnel and all.
Well, if it's going to be like the Great Escape, make sure there are trail bikes,
Jude said.
So you're in?
He shrugged.
As long as I get to play Steve McQueen.
Spending days with St. Angelo and Griggs becomes a habit for the rest of the holidays. Most of the time the Mullet brothers, Choi, Ben, St. Angelo's sisters and Jessa McKenzie come along as well. We end up either at St. Angelo's place or Raffi's, but mostly the former because Raffi's mum and dad teach the townies and keep on asking them for overdue homework. The St. Angelo home is like a madhouse. I'm not quite sure how his mum finds time to be the mayor of the town as well, but she manages. She's the only person who gets away with calling St. Angelo a little shit. and once in a while she'll go for the collective and refer to both Griggs and St. Angelo as those two little shits. Most of the time, the two little shits take it on the chin. But sometimes St. Angelo says, "I'm fucking out of here." And his mum warns, "Don't you dare swear, you little shit!" The St. Angelo sisters, Griggs and Raffi, ignore it all. But Jessa and I are fascinated and frightened at the same time. We wait for a showdown, but it tends not to happen, and then everything's all calm again, and the only two left in a mess are Jessa and me. Sometimes we are very relieved to escape it all. It's during those moments that I notice how similar we are. Both Jessa and I have spent almost half our lives brought up by people other than our parents, and neither of us have siblings. She has no recollection of her mother, who died of cancer when Jessa was 2 years old, and I have too much recollection of mine. She lived with her aunt, but here I worshipped her father, who died when she was 9 in some apparent freak accident, and my only memory of my father is of being on his shoulders and touching the sky. Though after St. Angelo's revelation about the boy in the photo, I'm not too sure anymore. More than anything, we have Hannah in common. And somehow during these holidays, I begin to see Jessa as a kind of link to whatever it is out there that I need to work out. "Do you think of Hannah a lot?" she asks me when we move back to the house close to the end of the holidays. I'm letting her sleep in the spare bed in my room because everyone else isn't back until the weekend and there's no one else in the dorms. All the time, I want to say. Sometimes. "Do you think something's happened to her?" she asks quietly. All the time, I want to say. Sometimes. "Taylor, just say the serious..."
"Don't,"
I say, irritated, turning over away from her. "Jessa, forget the serial killer. There are enough other things to worry about."
"She'd never leave us, so it could only be the serial killer."
I grit my teeth and count to 10 so I won't yell at her. "He only takes teenagers," I say, not so reassuringly. "She's in her 30s.
"But I read on this website that in the township stretching from the Sturt to the Hume highways, there have been 11 attempted kidnaps and 3 actual kidnaps of women over 25 in the last 10 years.
"Can I suggest another website?"
"It's www.shutupaboutthesserialkiller.com.
She is silent for a moment and I feel guilty about the aggression.
"If Hannah doesn't come back, I'll have no one,"
she says in the smallest voice I've heard her use. I reluctantly turn to face her again. But looking at Jess's face always has this sledgehammer effect on me. So I lie on my back and stare at the ceiling. "Hannah's coming back. Anyway, you've got whoever looked after you before you came here."
"My aunt. But she has my cousins, and I know she likes me, even loves me, but it's not like I felt as if I belonged. Until Hannah turned up."
"She turned up one day. Just like that."
"Uh-huh. I thought she was so beautiful. She said, 'Let me look at you.' And then she cried and held me and said that if she had known about me, she would have come much sooner."
"Funny. She turned up just like that for me as well."
"Maybe she's like in that TV show where those angels moonlight as people and they come down to help others. You know, like In Touch by an Angel."
"I don't think she's an angel, Jessa. She swears worse than St. Angela on Griggs." I turn and lean on my elbow, facing her. "So what did she say when she showed up?"
"That she was a friend of my dad's, but I don't really believe that. I couldn't imagine Hannah knowing my dad, and she seemed much younger than him anyway."
"I've never known my father," I tell her.
"My aunt said mine was a crazy man and that he lost his marbles years ago, but I don't think he was, you know. I think he was just really sad."
"Maybe because your mum died."
"I don't know. But when he came to visit, he'd tell me the best stories about growing up around here. When Hannah told me I'd be coming here when I was 12, I was ecstatic."
She looks at me intently.
"She used to talk about you. She'd tell me that when I came to the school, I would have you, and that she'd be the luckiest person in the world because she'd have both of us. I used to think she was your mum."
I have a mother, and she's not Hannah.
But don't you ever wish she was? I do.
I don't answer. I just wish Hannah would come back and tell me off like she used to. Or even keep me a little at arm's length, which she always seemed to do with me. Not like Jessa. I'd watch them together. Hannah would smother Jessa with kisses and cuddles, and they'd giggle like kids. Maybe my guard was up all the time and she was reacting to that, but I wish she had seen through it, and I wish that once, just once, I'd told her how I felt. That I felt safer when she was around. Sometimes I had tested her, wanting so desperately for her to let me down, so then I would have an excuse to walk away. But she never did. I wish I could tell her it breaks my heart that I miss her more than I ever miss my mother. And that the thing that frightens me the most about next October when I graduate is not that I won't have a home, but that I won't have her.
You know what?
Jessa says after a moment, yawning.
I reckon that brigadier knows where she is.
My pulse does this thumping thing that happens every time I think of him. Why do you say that? Has he ever hassled you? Tell me. She frowns, and I don't know whether it's because she remembers something or because of my aggression.
He looks at me all the time.
Does it freak you out? I ask, not wanting to put more fear in her head.
No, but Chloe P. reckons he could be the serial killer.
Oh, please, I say, even though I once thought the same.
She reckons whoever it is lives between Sydney and Truscott.
Which covers 700 kilometres, narrowing our suspects down to about 1 million people.
And the kidnappings have always taken place between September and the end of the year and would probably be committed by someone who drives those 700 kilometres. The brigadier would get to cover at least 500 of them. He goes back and forth from Sydney to here all the time. Well, this year he has anyway. Last year he wasn't around, or the year before, and there were no kidnappings.
How do you know?
That he wasn't around last year. Because Teresa, one of the hostages, is going around with one of the cadets, and he told her, and she told me.
Can you point out to Teresa that the cadets are our enemy, and she's not allowed to go around with one of them?
But you passed Jonah Griggs and he's the leader of the enemy.
I stare at her in amazement with absolutely no comeback.
We saw you at the party on Saturday night,
she says, grinning.
We thought it was really romantic.
Who's we?
Mary and Sarah and Alicia and Tilly Santangelo and their cousins and some of their friends from school. How can you breathe when his tongue
go to sleep? I say, turning over again. I wanted to say that I didn't need to breathe on my own when Jonah Griggs was kissing me. But since he hasn't touched me since that night, I can't even bring myself to think of him. It's not like he's ignoring me, because that would be proactive. It's like I'm just anyone to him. Even when we were squashed in the back seat, our knees glued together and our shoulders touching, and my insides were full of butterflies, he was speaking over my head the whole time with San Angelo about some ridiculous AFL rugby league thing. Somewhere along the way, Jonah Griggs has become a priority in my life, and his attitude this week has been crushing. On the last Saturday of the holidays, San Angelo takes Griggs, Raffy and me back to the place by the river on the other side of town. He's convinced that there is some other clue down there to do with the missing boy. And if there is one thing I've noticed about San Angelo, it's that he has a touch of obsessive-compulsive about him and won't let an idea go.
Apparently, the hermit was obsessed with this river.
He tells us.
Why do you think that is?
He persists. I just shrug, but I can tell Raffy and Griggs are trying to come up with something intelligent. When nobody answers, he holds out his hands as if to say,
"Go on, answer." San Angelo, you're dying to tell us, so just tell us.
Greg says, irritated.
Because I think he knew that kid, Xavier.
Webb, I say, and the three of them look at me. That's what they called him.
Webb.
He nods.
Well, think of this river. There are so many bends where stuff going down the river gets lodged.
Stuff? I ask. Wow, hold back on the jargon.
so let's go in.
Greg says,
It's deep, and by the time you get to the bottom and check out what's down there, you'll have to come back up again for breath.
I'll go down, Raffi said. I'm the 1,500-meter swimmer and can hold my breath the longest. I watch the guys. It's as if she stripped them of their masculinity. It's no big deal. It's just about better lungs, she reassures them, turning to face me and rolling her eyes as she takes off her shoes and socks. The guys are not coping, and I sit back and hug my knees to watch the show.
How do you know Griggs isn't a long-distance swimmer who has fantastic lungs?
San Angelo asks. Because he looks like a rugby player, not a swimmer. Raffi tells him, You look like an AFL player, not a swimmer. I look like a swimmer. What about me? I ask. The three of them look at me. Being tall has never meant I was labelled as athletic. Just lanky. You look like someone who's going to get a really, really high UAI. Raffi says. I won the table tennis 2 years in a row. I remind her. But you're not a swimmer. She says.
You only beat me in the 1500 that one time.
San Angelo says. I can tell this could go on forever, and I'm not in the mood. Look, I say. He beat you in the spelling bee, she beat you in the 1500 metres. Let's just get this Fab Four adventure over and done with and go home. I think the two of us should go in. Raffi says, taking off her top.
Look the other way.
San Angelo tells Griggs as she unzips her jeans.
As if.
When Raffi is down to her undies and singlet, she dives in with ease. Her head emerges, her teeth chattering. San Angelo begins to strip as well, and I certainly don't look the other way. As soon as San Angelo and Raffi's heads go under, Griggs leans over and kisses me. It's a hungry kind of kiss, like he's been dying to do it for ages and he can't get enough. But after a while, I open my eyes and just stare at him.
You're supposed to close your eyes.
He says, a little unnerved. I'm not supposed to do anything. I say, moving away from him and looking into the river, waiting for Raffi and St. Angelo to come back up.
Is there a problem here?
There's nothing here.
Really? Because that wasn't the message you were giving me last Saturday night.
And between last Saturday and today, there have been at least 6 days, so let's just say that I'm going by the message that you've been giving me since then.
We've been surrounded by the San Angelo Circus and that pest who is either attached to you surgically or me. And then when they're not around, Casanova Cassidy is hanging off every word you say. Or Raffi's giving me one of those girl's own only looks.
He says.
So if I haven't been giving you the attention...
So you're admitting it, that you can just switch this on and off?
Yeah, whatever you say, I'm over it.
Oh, good, because I was never into it. I feel like someone off Jerry Springer. Any moment now I'm going to be saying boyfriend with a bit of Afro-American attitude thrown in. But I can't help it. St. Angelo emerges, and I feel horrible because I've almost forgotten that they're down there. He swings around looking for Raffi, and I move closer to the river until her head appears. Anything? I ask, as if there was a likelihood that they would find something constructive just because we were looking for it.
No.
San Angelo says, dragging himself out.
But there are heaps of tree trunks lying on the bottom, and anything could be stuck in or under them.
San Angelo comes up with yet another idea about getting some diving material for a better search. But I'm not listening anymore, and neither is Griggs. San Angelo and Raffi drop us off on the Jellicoe Road, and I get out without saying a word and walk away. But Griggs is right behind me.
So... explain to me again what I did wrong.
I don't stop. You know what? You didn't do anything wrong. I did. It's this dumb thing I do. I look into things and see more than I'm supposed to.
You're implying that last week meant nothing to me.
This time I do stop, staring at him. It's not an implication. It's a fact. Just like when we ran away. No big deal, Griggs.
It was a big deal. So why are you pretending that it isn't?
No, it wasn't. It was just a coincidence. We were waiting for the same train, for the same reason, to go see our mothers, and maybe being together meant more to me than it did to you.
Maybe I've got to stop believing that not everyone feels the same way I do about things. Like my mother, I want to say to him. Like Hannah. Like you.
I wrote to you for a year and you never wrote back.
He says.
I rang you over and over again and you would never come to the phone. What part of that gives the impression that I didn't care?
You know what I think? I tell him. You thought I was too much baggage. Or maybe you got bored. Like she would have. She'd get bored being good. She'd get bored trying to go clean. She got bored being my mother. And I wanted to ask her why. But you switched off and you rang the brigadier to come and get you when I was so close to where I wanted to be. And I can't believe that you preferred to miss out on seeing your mum and brother just so you wouldn't have to spend another moment with me. He shakes his head like he can't believe what he's hearing.
I didn't ring the brigadier.
He snaps.
I didn't even know him at the time. And one day, when you're interested, I might tell you why I rang my school. But for the time being, why don't you just continue feeling sorry for yourself and comparing the rest of the world with your mother? That will make you popular.
He crosses the road, but not without a parting look of such hostility that it makes me ill. There will be no one day, I yell. Because holidays are over, Griggs, and you and I are never going to cross paths again. Not in the next 10 days, not ever. Have a fantastic life. He walks back towards me, and I take a step back, not because I'm scared, but because he doesn't give me much room, and this is Griggs without control. Apart from the train and that time in the scout hall, I've never seen him like this. I've seen measured Griggs who provokes the fight, who is never taken by surprise, who walks at his own pace to the beat of life, but not Griggs like he is now.
Be careful what you wish for,
he says with quiet menace.
Because I'm about this close to telling you to get the fuck out of my life.
I stare at him.
What do you want from me?
He asks. What I want from every person in my life, I want to tell him. More. But I don't say anything, and neither of us move.
What if I told you that I lied that day on the platform?
He says after a moment. You're lying now, I say angrily. Don't you dare try to get out of the fact that you were missing your mother and brother and you wanted to see them. You were a mess. I was there, remember? He shakes his head.
I lied.
Am I supposed to think you're all tough because you don't need people, Griggs? Is that what you're trying to do here?
No. That's your thing.
Then stop lying and admit you were there because you missed your family.
I've missed my mother and brother every day that I've been out here this time round. But not that day.
There is something in his eyes that frightens the hell out of me and I want to walk away. I don't want to hear another word because I know that whatever he has to say is going to destroy a part of me.
I knew who you were before that day.
He says,
some morbid prick pointed you out to me in the street when I arrived here that first year. He told me how some hermit had whispered something in your ear and then blown his brains out.
The words are brutal. I've never really heard it described that way. I blocked my ears for a moment, but when you block your ears, you tend to close your eyes. And when I close my eyes, I see blood and brain matter. And I smell the sickly scent of blood. So you were at the train station and saw me come along and you thought I'd be a fun person to hang out with for a weekend. I say snidely. And you made up some story about wanting to see your mother and brother.
No. I was waiting for the train. The 3:47, yes. Comes every afternoon and according to the station master, it's never late. And I knew that. And then you came along. And you spoke to me. And nobody had looked me in the eye for years. My mum wouldn't. She told me later that she couldn't, because she was scared to see that I might hate her. She feels like she didn't protect me from him. But I remember you that day, and you looked at peace with yourself, and it made me reconsider everything I had planned to do. Because I thought to myself, you can't do this to her, not after the hermit thing.
Do what to me? I don't think that leaving me on that platform would have changed my life, Griggs. I lie.
You being on that platform changed mine.
This isn't romance. This isn't a declaration of love or affirmation of friendship. This is something more.
I wasn't there that day to get on the 347 to Yas.
He says,
I was there to throw myself in front of it.